Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to Podcart and welcome to another episode with a guest. And today is Kapil Sesasai.
Yep.
Yay! We did it. I was just saying to Kapil before we started there, I'm used to my name being mispronounced. So I always feel guilty when I mispronounce other people's names.
But no, I do all the time. Thank you
so much. So you have, we'll come to your album, your new album soon that's been recently released, but you've picked 6 songs for us.
Yeah.
And we're going to have a chat.
Yeah. Sounds great.
So first of all, I guess what I want to know is what was your first entry into music or your first musical memory?
My first musical memory is I grew up in a family with loads of classical musicians in it, and my cousins are classical singers, and they're just older than me. They're older than me enough that when I was a toddler, they were like 10, 11. And my earliest memory is hearing them kind of do their vocal exercises in the other room when I was sleeping. And watching them do gigs in like Hindu temples and watching them play music along with the harmonium and stuff, like it really, I don't know, it really resonated with me even from a young age. Like I didn't know what they were doing, but I really liked it. And I think that's always been swirling around in my head somewhere. Mm-hmm. So I suppose, yeah, listening to my cousins play music was the earliest memory. They still play it, which is really nice.
And you have the album, obviously, that you've just recently released. How many records have you put out now?
Two EPs, a standalone single, and this record.
Yeah.
And I had three singles, yeah.
So the album is, in terms of production values, it's phenomenal.
I'm so proud of the production of it, just because the guy I worked with, Stuart McLachlan, he plays in Britney. I mean, he's the vocalist from Britney, and he does, like, he needs in half form things and things as well. But yeah, we collaborated really closely on this, and he couldn't have done like a better job. I asked him initially because the guitar tone on all the Britney records is incredible, and like that made me want to work with him. But we have such a shared taste in terms of music that he likes all the random tangents. I know he likes loads of things that go off of random tangents just like me. So to have collaborated this closely on it was really great. And he did, and he couldn't have done a better job, I think.
You've got many strings to your bow. But I do want to talk a bit about the album.
The
thing I love about the album is that there's so many kind of melodious passages through it, but it takes you in directions that you just are not expecting at all. And I love the kind of contradictions in the songwriting and the delivery of it. Mm-hmm. What was your approach to your songwriting?
I approached the album like I was writing an essay, and each song was a chapter, and I wanted to structure it so that each chapter was like a narrative on the different guises that oppression based on caste can take. So it was really easy in the sense that the narrative really drove what the songs were going to be about and what I'd be writing about. When it came to the melodies, it got more complicated. I was listening to loads and loads of new things when I was writing this record, but in terms of the narrative of the record, it was very much thinking about it like an essay. Like, the first song on the record's like the title track, and the title track I would think of as like an abstract for the essay. Like, it's kind of telling you what the album's about. It's telling you what my position in the caste system is. It's a strange position to write from, because my family are upper caste and we don't face any caste oppression ourselves. I'm kind of singing about...
I want to kind of make sure that people that are listening understand you mean by that.
Uh-huh. Essentially, the Indian caste system is like, it's like a very antiquated class system based on Hindu scripture. And essentially the way it works is... there's just like in the West, there are upper class people, there are middle class people, there are lower class people, and below the class system itself, there's this tier called the untouchables, who are deemed to be so impure and so lowly, shall we say, that they're not even allowed to be in the system. And the way it works is that you're only really allowed to fraternize with people at your level, and that you're only allowed to marry people at your level, and you're only allowed to, and there are only certain professions that each level can be able to do. Because the way it works is in the Hindu holy book, it talks about how each tier in the class system has a set of jobs and like attributes that they can do. Like, for example, the caste I'm from, we're near the top, and we're thought of as like priests, all the, like taking care of temples, reading scripture, delivering scripture. That's what my caste would have done in ancient Hindu society. But the unfortunate thing is that society has moved on for thousands of years, and that a lot of these discriminations don't make any sense, and a lot of these jobs the jobs adhered to by caste don't make any sense anymore. But the problem is that modern India and Indian communities in diaspora are so entrenched in these really antiquated ways of thinking and these really antiquated class tiers that you've now got modern situations in which contemporary, like, people can't get jobs outside. They can't have ideas above their station, if you want. If you're of a certain caste, you can't get that job. There's no class mobility. If you fall in love with somebody who's not the same caste as you, you can't be with them unless your family wants to break caste too, and that never happens. And it gets even more violent than that. And I talk about this on the album a lot, is this that caste is often thought of as this really bygone thing from, like, a country no one's ever heard of, but it's so real and it's so visible and it's so active in the West today that, you know, There's the second song in the album is about honor killings, and people think that when I'm referring to the honor killings, I'm referring to ones from like hundreds of years ago. But a lot of the cases I make reference to have happened in the last 20 years.
Yeah.
And a lot of them have happened in the West as well. Like, there's a specific murder that really, really shook me reading about it. And it was about a Canadian woman who like met someone in India who was Sikh as well as she was Sikh, but he was of a different caste to her, and her family were so angry at her disobeying that, that they murdered her. Her own family murdered her over who she chose to fall in love with. And it really shook me reading that, and that really drove me to want to put that album, to bring this album out, and to really, like, you know, try and send this message out as far as I can, just to send the, you know, just to raise awareness of the cause, I guess.
And what you're saying about the meaning behind the album, mm-hmm. Your family and friends, and I guess any relatives or people that you know that are part of the caste system and so on, how have they reacted to the
album? It's been a very, it's been a strange one, actually. I've had family members be very, like, vocal about their disapproval of the album, because they talk about caste and racial tension in India being high as it is, and why am I stirring the pot even more by bringing it out? But the way I see it is that we can't really live in this world where, like, we can't have any nuance, and, you know, a race of people can't be just good or just bad. It's more complicated than that, mm-hmm. you know? And that I've had loads and loads of support from friends, and I've had loads and loads of support, especially had loads of support from Indians living in the West, because to them, caste is this thing that's really active in the house, but they leave home, and then their white pals don't know what it is, so they can't bring it up in conversation. It's not even that it's taboo, it's just, it's so emotionally exhausting to bring it up that they don't try, and they just kind of suffer in silence. And with this album, I'm hoping that at least caste gets brought to a platform of discourse where someone can bring up something to do with caste, and people might actually know what it is, or might have a rudimentary understanding of it, I guess.
Yeah. We're going to come back to that.
Sure.
But let's talk about you. It's quite a kind of mixed bag that you've bought today in terms of the tracks.
Yeah,
that
yeah,
you've
yeah,
put.
Yeah. All sorts.
So first of all, John Martin.
Oh, he's one of my heroes.
Why John? When did you discover him, and why this song?
I chose this song because loads of people kind of like write John Martin off as like a 70s folkie who had two good albums and then went into obscurity. He never got the fame he deserved in his lifetime, but I chose a really late period John Martin song just to kind of show off that he was good the whole time he was alive, but people don't know. And as someone who works as a promoter in Scotland, music from Scotland having visibility means so much to me, as I'm sure it does to yourself. And like, I wanted to choose somebody who's got a lot of Scottish heritage as well as John Martin does. It's from an album called Glasgow Walker as well.
So sweet, this pain for real.
Someone who's only heard Solid Air or May You Never, his hits, if they're hits at all, like, it doesn't sound like the same guy, but it is. And I wanted to just show that over 25, 30 years that he can progress from a guy with a guitar to so much more. It was really funny, I didn't really grow up with much Western music in the house, so my best friend from school, Ian, his parents were very, very into their 70s rock. So whenever I went round to his house, I'd get played all these, like, these records that would seem really wild and out there to me because I didn't have any context for them. And, like, some of, like, a lot of John Martin's 70s output was in there. And we used to sit and listen to him all the time. And, like, he was still touring at that point. So in about 2008, 2009, I had the pleasure of seeing him live near the end of his life. And he's kind of a tragic figure in that a lot of really terrible things happened to him. And to a lot of people, you know, he's a lot of different things to a lot of different people. But to me, you know, I listen to his music regardless of what era it comes from. And I remember being 17 and discovering it for the first time. And to know he was from Scotland meant a lot as well. I think when you listen to a lot of these quote-unquote classic albums, they're always made by people in America or in London. And you think, oh, these people are from, like, another world. I don't know who they are. But the idea that he grew up in the Shawlands and, like, he would tour from somewhere random and come back to Glasgow, really, like, I don't know, it really spoke to me at a point where I didn't think, it seems really silly to grow up in Glasgow but not be aware of live music, but when you're younger and you're not old enough to go to gigs and stuff yet, or, like, smaller gigs, you almost don't realise how localised the music that you can really fall in love with is, I suppose, so yeah. I guess that's why I chose it.
You mentioned there about your best friend Ian and listening to the music that his parents played. So what was the music that was being played in your own home?
Two things, Bollywood disco and the music of Cliff Richard. But none of, like, not even like what people would consider good by Cliff Richard. We're talking about midlife crisis Cliff Richard, so like late 90s onwards. There was a VHS of all this stuff that my dad would put on all the time. I don't know why I've told you that, but it's out there in the world now.
So Bollywood disco.
Yeah. So it was like there was like a weird gap. So it would be like a bunch of, like, Bollywood discs from like 1978 to like 83. Then there'd be like a massive gap, and then mid 90s onwards, Cliff Richard, and there was nothing in the middle. If my parents kind of ignored anything that happened between that. Ironically, so much of my favorite music comes from the period in between those two years.
When you were listening to music in your friend's house, did that just kind of entice you into investigating more?
Yeah, for sure. It's really funny because loads of people hate dad rock because their dads listen to it, but my dad didn't listen to, like, dad rock, so it didn't feel lame or anything, or like I didn't need to rebel against it. I could just throw myself into it and really, really enjoy it. Yeah. Me and that friend Ian, we would listen to so many records together. And there's like few records from the 70s that I didn't hear for the first time with him in earshot somewhere too. And I think he was kind of the same. You know, he didn't feel the need to rebel against music that his parents listened to. And there was a lot of that kind of, you know, it'd be really funny that we'd phone each other up and discuss records that come out like 30 years ago and discuss them like they'd just come out and be like, oh, what do you think? And this was before social media and stuff, so you couldn't just send each other messages. You'd blather on the phone about albums and stuff you liked. So I talk about it like it was in the 70s. It was like, what, 2005 or something. Oh dear.
So Joni Mitchell, who's, I mean,
what can you say? People always make fun. It's really funny. There's like a running joke across everywhere I've ever played a gig now that's outside of Glasgow that I'm far too into the music of Steely Dan, who are like not a cool band to like. But and you know, I'll talk about something like cultural appropriation, but then be like, oh, but you've given Steely Dan a pass. But yeah, but when it sounds that good, you just have to. Which isn't a quote people should use, but it's out there now. But I couldn't decide on a song by Joni Mitchell or a song by Steely Dan, so I chose the Joni Mitchell song that reminded me of Steely Dan a wee bit. But no, this is my favourite song of all time for a short time. It's Car on a Hill by Joni Mitchell. Same argument as John Martin. I think a lot of people kind of write her off as like, kind of like someone who had like a really good folk, like maybe 3-4 really good folk albums and then vanished from view. Whereas she kind of discovered jazz after that, and she has this trio of records where she's like, she doesn't really play that much guitar or any acoustic on it, but she's like arranging everything. And you know, this is off an album called Court and Spark, but Hissing of Summer Lawns, this album, Court and Spark, and Hijira are like, to me, that's the strongest run of albums ever. And, you know, it's very like, it's not difficult, but it's much more like meandering than a lot of her folky stuff. But I chose this song just because, to me, it's got one of the best vocal melodies of all time. But simultaneously, there are so many ideas that sneak past you and you have to listen a few times to find them all. And it's almost like you're going on this, you're almost hunting for, what else does she fit? What else has she hidden in this song for me to find, I guess? But yeah, I've always been obsessed with this era for work ever since I was a teenager, and I'm always coming back to them because to me it's almost like the alphabet in terms of songwriting. Like, mm-hmm. I think everything, every good idea someone could have in a song is in there somewhere, and you have to keep coming back to that well, I think, for inspiration. So
the taking of Pelham 1-2-3.
There's like two people who will be really excited that I chose this.
Okay.
I hope that
this is for those two people.
Yeah, this
then.
is for my two good friends from uni who like they played me this for the first time, and I can't. This was my favourite theme to anything for a long, long time. Thank you. written by one of my favorite composers, David Shire. His big film that he did the soundtrack for was The Conversation. It was a Francis Ford Coppola film in the 70s. And that film, I don't know why I'm talking about another soundtrack by the same guy, but The Conversation is incredible in that it's got this very, very, very soft piano score throughout. But then later on in the film, the music gets horrifically noisy. But what you're hearing is the tape loops of the really quiet piano track being ripped up and taped back together and then being played. And it's the idea that well before computers had the role that they did in production, that someone was being that wild in the studio with a film soundtrack of all things, but not getting in the way of the film really, like... Yeah, I found it really inspiring. I'm really, really into my crime thrillers. And I find that the music of this specific era of thrillers as well, it was like composers like David Shire and Jerry Fielding. And they were all doing really, really, really interesting things with soundtracks. And like this particular film, I think it's a great film. Like the naming conventions for the characters in Reservoir Dogs, they were based on the characters in this film. And before I sang my own songs and things, I was I worked in a theatre company just being the in-house composer, so I would do little soundtracks for them, and I did.
I was going to ask you about composing, but I'll let you finish.
And I did music for like short films and things, and when I got back into music again, it was like, oh, I've got all these ideas from when I was doing soundtracking, and a lot of those have just ended up in my work as a result, I suppose. So I wanted to pick like something that kind of reference that point in my life where soundtrack, where working as like someone who did soundtracks was like really pivotal. So yeah, you were gonna say.
Yeah, so I mean, for me, the album is very much a score. It's it's so clever in the compositions throughout. The instrumentation, I mean, we were talking, your partner plays flute on tracks, and it's just, there's just so many little kind of layers to it that really comes, and now that I kind of understand the classical background that you have and so on, then that really makes me understand it a bit more. Would you ever consider, have you done any more composition for film or anything like
not
that lately?
No, it seems like I've kind of gotten headfirst into just making my own music, but I'd love to return to it at some point. No, that would be really fun. Like, I used to do it all the time for this small indie theatre company in Glasgow. And we went to London with a production of Merchant of Venice, and that was really fun. Mm-hmm. And that was the last big thing I did for soundtrack, and that was a good 5-6 years ago. But I would come back to it, I think. I feel like I've grown as a composer since I've been writing my own music. So I'd be interested in doing it, but I have you know, this album's part one of like a trilogy, so I need to finish those.
Spark and fire, and you can let's
I can't understand why people would struggle with the vocal on that song. We were just talking about that while that was playing. I think it's so brutal and raw and wonderful.
Oh, no, it's like I discovered them when I was about 21, 22, and I just obsessively had to listen to anything that had his voice in it. And, my flatmates didn't go for it much. But, his voice has a scent, this emotion to it that I don't think anything really matches, to be honest. And there are so many vocals that sound a bit like it, but they're never the same, I think. You can always tell when someone's trying to ape it. Yeah, Joan of Arc, Tim Kinsella in particular, is a real hero, I think, and that no one's really doing what he's doing and no one's ever done what he's done.
And so we were talking just about shows in Glasgow and so on. So you promote shows.
Yeah.
How many years have you been promoting for now?
4 or 5. Not too long.
What was the first gig that you promoted?
My first couple of shows was like, I tried to put on a show. I wanted to play in a show in Edinburgh, but I knew bands in Edinburgh, but I didn't know any promoters. So I decided to put on a show with myself. Yeah. And it was myself who played, which is a really big no-no when you're a promoter, is to put yourself on. But first show, whatever. Put myself on a band called Brittany, who were great. Their vocalist recorded this album, and he did an amazing job. And a band called Endless Swarm from Edinburgh, who've just put out a new album, I think, who are really great. I'm going to try and see them on their next tour. But yeah, it was them and a band called Fatalists from Edinburgh, who've been going like a long time. A really, really lovely bunch of guys. I'm glad all these bands are still going as well, because there's like a bunch of shows where it'll be like a timeline thing on Facebook, and it'll show you, oh, remember when you put this show on from like 3 years ago? And you look at it and you go, oh my God, none of those bands are active anymore. And oh my God, that venue's not active anymore. And it'll be depressing. So it's like a nice, it's a rare delight, I think, when you're aware of like all the bands from a gig that you put on or played years ago still being active, mm-hmm. I guess. So yeah, that was my first show that I put on, and it went well, so I kept doing it.
What's your favourite show that you've ever put on?
I thought about this the other day. Like, my favourite show ever, it's another one of the songs I chose. My favourite show that I've ever put on was when I put Shilpa Ray on at the 13th note.
It's weighing down on me.
My favourite thing about the show was the incompetency of the booking on my part. In that, like, I didn't know how many people would come because she played the O2 with Nick Cave. I think it was the... Were you there?
No, like, I read about this and that is... I mean, that's mind-blowing.
Yeah. You know, she told me the story of how Nick Cave, like, discovered her. I don't know if she talked about it.
I've not heard this story.
Oh, it's incredible. She worked in a denim factory and... she had a really bad day at work that day, and like a pen had burst on her hand, and it would like, apparently there was a big stain all the way up her sleeve, and she was like, this is the worst day ever. And then Nick Cave turned up at her work, but with his two sons, who looked a bit like him, but smaller, and apparently they were all dressed really similarly, and he demanded to speak to her, and all three of them walked up to her and said, I want you to come on tour with me. And the next thing she knew, she was on tour with Nick Cave.
That's insane.
Yeah. My favourite part of that story is that his two sons, who looked a bit like him, were there. It's just the idea of the three Caves coming at you from a distance on your worst day at work.
That's so bizarre.
But my favourite show was her at 13th Note. And I did not know how... I wasn't sure if I should have booked Stereo, to be brutally honest. But in a way, maybe I shouldn't have, because that show was at capacity.
Yeah.
And it was amazing. And... I wanted to try something with that show, and I wanted to see what I could manage with an all-women of colour lineup. So it was her headlining with her band, Joyce Delaney, which has loads of, you know, notable Glasgow figures in it. It's got Chrissy Barnacle in it. It's got Nyla in it as well, who's like an academic on comic books, but she also does loads of visibility stuff for women of colour, and she has her own solo stuff, which is fantastic. And a band called Velma, which features Diljit Bachu, who played flute on my record, and Sister, who are like a spoken word collective who talk about women of colour and people of colour issues who open. It was mostly Shilpa Ray's kind of fans who came out, but so many people came out. And my favourite thing about that is that she'd clearly not played Glasgow that much since she played with Nick Cave, but she clearly reached so many people that those people all were watching her enough to be like, right, I'm gonna play Glasgow, and all these people came out. And it's the busiest show I've ever put on, mostly because I put it on in such a small venue. But the lead single from her last album, it's a really, really shouty, like very 70s sounding punk rock song. And she has such a shouty vocal on it. And when she played that song near the end of her set at the gig, she rushed into the big crowd and was in amongst all of them, and they were all dancing and singing, and it was like, I have a video of it that I think it's on my Instagram somewhere, and it was just incredible to think that I had helped make this happen. I was really, not to take anything away from the performers, it was, you know, it was her pull and her artistry that brought all these people to the gig, but it was really nice to have made that many people happy at once, if you want.
Well, you're still part of the jigsaw, aren't you?
Yeah. But it's that weird thing where people thank you, but I didn't play or anything.
No, but it's still a big thing to... You know yourself, the work that goes into promoting a show.
Yeah,
it is,
sure.
And it's debilitating at times.
Yeah.
But you keep doing it because you love it.
Yeah. So. And it's really funny when you meet people who don't... They're not, you know... They're not aware of music past the one gig at the Hydra they go to every year, kind of thing. And you tell them you're a promoter, and they'll think of like some weird like 80s rock stereotype that you make ridiculous amounts of money every night, and you know, you go about in limousines and things, and like, no, getting my costs back is great, but it doesn't happen often, and it's literally just for the love of doing it that you do it. And it's the same with loads of people I know who do it.
TM Krishna, you said that you just recently...
Relative to the others, really, really recently. It was more like when I was... Like, we're talking really recently. Like, I have a good friend who lives in London, and she's, my parents and me we're all from the south of India, and the south of India is quite rarely represented in Indian music as a whole. A lot of the identity when it comes to Indians in diaspora tends to be North Indian, which is very, very different in terms of both its culture and its art and its, you know, religions and other things too. And my friend who lives in London, she's South Indian, and I have so few South Indian friends that we became really close really quickly. And she recommended TM Krishna's music to me, and he's like a Carnatic music is like a South Indian specific kind of Indian classical music. The singers that my cousins who are singers that I talked about earlier in this interview, they're Carnatic singers. And TM Krishna he's like a political activist and a Carnatic singer. And that combination just like blew me away, because he's also like an upper caste Indian who plays in these very classical music circles that are like traditionally very elitist and full of really snobby people, you know, who would be castist in the way that I described in songs like Caustic Wet. And T.M. Krishna has kind of pushed against this narrative by trying to bring Carnatic music to people of a lower class. And he's done this in loads of incredible ways. He's tried to create gigs in accessible places that are free of charge for people to attend, because so many people live below the poverty line in India that the idea of eating day to day is impossible, let alone going to a gig for the evening.
Nilayada samudiramana samsara turekanin murgi 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 nisamana dena palla pesigatino ಾಗಿ ಪೆರಿಯೋರ್ಗಳಿದೆ ಕರವಾಗಿ ನಿನವಾಲಿ ನಡಿತೋಳಿ ಪೇಣಿ ತೂದಿಯ ತಲೆಯ ನವುಡರ್ ಪಣಿ ಪೂರಿ ಫಲ ನೋಯೇ ನಲೈ ಬಲವೇಗೆ ತಲೆಯ ನವುಡರ್ ಪಣಿ ಪೂರಿ ಫಲ ನೋಯೇ ನಲೈ ಬಲವೇಗೆ ಸಲಮಾ ಪೈತಿಯಮಾಗಿ ತಡಮಾದಿ ತವಿಯಾಮಲ್ ಪಿರಪಯು ನಾಡಿ ಅದು ಬೇರೆಯರು ತುಣಯೋದಿ ತಲಮೀದಿಲ್ ಪಿಳೈ ತಿಡವೇ ನಿನ್ನ ರುಳ್ತಾರಾಯ್ ಕಲಿಯನ ಸುಭದಿರನಾದ ಪುರಮಾದ ತನ ಕಲಿಯಾನ ಸುಬದಿರನಾಗ ಪುರಮಾದ ತನಗ ವಿನೋದ ಕವಿನಾರು ಪುನತಿಲುಲಾವಿ ಪಿಳಯಾಡಿ ಕಲಿಕೂರ್ ಮುನೈ ತುಣೈ ತೇಡು ಅಡಿಗೆನೆ ಸುಗ ಪಡವೇವೈ ಕಡನಾರ ಮಿದು ಕಣಮಾವು படி மீது துதித்துடன் வாழ அருள்வாயே பதியான திருத்தனி மேவு சிவலோகம் என்ன பரிவேறு பவரோக வைத்தியநாத பெருமாள்
He's actually, like, it's incredible. There's all these YouTube videos of him setting up gigs in weirder and weirder places. There's this incredible YouTube video where he's on a bus and, like, there's this bus full of commuters and he's got, like, a guy playing percussion and, like, a guy with, like, a small harmonium creating, like, a drone, and he's just doing vocalizations over it. And the way I'm describing it sounds like he's inconveniencing loads of passengers, but, like, everyone's really, like, enraptured by it, and it's incredible that he's gone to this great length, and he doesn't have to, do you know what I mean? He's obviously set for life just off how talented he is, but he's decided that the idea of Carnatic music being an art form closed off to a certain level of class and above is terrible, and that more people who aren't able to access it otherwise should be able to. And he's gone to these great lengths to do it as well. He's had a lot of pushback, a lot more aggressive pushback than my albums had, because I live in the West after all.
Yeah.
And he lives in India, and he's had like death threats and people picketing his gigs, but he takes that risk and he's going to these like public places, like, you know, public transport, little town squares, villages. He's going to these places and he's trying to bring this music to people, and I think that's really inspiring. And that, you know, it's even more, it's like tenfold when he's not in the West. He's not just doing it removed from the cruelties of the situation. He's doing it in a place where he's risking real bodily harm here to do this. So mm-hmm. he's a very recent obsession of mine that my friend Ananya introduced me to. And I'm really thankful that there's other people singing about caste and that are doing these great things on Liquor, because he's on a really mainstream platform as well, but in a lot of elite music circles, and a lot of people are turning up their nose at the idea that he's singing to poor folk. But the fact that he's doing that and he doesn't care what they think is incredible, I think.
Yeah.
And I just had to include him on this list.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
So your album's out now.
Yep.
Sacred Boar.
Yeah. Well, the album launch gigs are after that. The album comes out in vinyl on the 14th of December. I play Leith Depot in Edinburgh that day, and I haven't played Glasgow in a wee while, so I'm playing the album launch, or the vinyl launch show, is on the 15th of December at the Hug and Pint in the West End. So play Glasgow, and then I've already started working on the second record, so there's going to be a wee writing period during that point, but during that time I'm just going to go back to promoting a lot, to be honest, so yeah. I'm not going to vanish, don't worry.
And have you picked your supports for the shows in Scotland?
Yeah I'll be announcing them very shortly, but to a lot of people who've seen me play before and who know me personally, the supports won't come as any surprise, but like, no, I'm looking forward to announcing them really, really soon.
It's a beautiful body of work. I cannot wait to get vinyl.
That means a lot. Thanks so much.
I say, there's so many different layers to it. And obviously, now that you've explained I know you've done interviews and things like that, and in depth in terms of what you do, but mm-hmm. it's just nice to hear it from you direct,
yeah, for
I
sure.
guess.
Yeah, yeah, and
You expressing it in your own way. I think you hear someone just expressing it with their own voice, rather than reading someone else's words. I wish you all the best with this.
That means
I
so
know
much. Thanks
how
so much.
Fucking hard you work. So
I think if you don't believe in it, other people won't believe in it. So you have to just kind of go as hard as you want, as you can, I suppose.
But you support so many other musicians as well, and you go to so many gigs.
I think it's important, though. You kind of have to be the change you want to see. Because I feel like you can complain about the kinds of bands you like not being successful, but if you're not in the audience watching them, they're not going to be successful. You know, like, you can't put loads of people there. You've kind of got to be one of them first, I guess. Yeah.
Good luck. Thank you so much for coming in to speak
to me.
No,
anytime. Thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.